What is it? And for whom? 5 years after the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan, a medical lifespan study of the survivors was begun. All calculations of risk and health damage, especially the likelihood of developing cancer, was based on the model of a typical military male, referred to as reference man. But over the years, as the resulting data were analyzed, reference man did not turn out to be the proper model for all concerned, because
boys were 5 times more likely to get cancer than the adult male who underpins the reference man. But little girls were 10 times more likely to get cancer over their lifetimes than the man who was adult at the time of exposure. Little girls were twice as likely than little boys. And that's the big question. Why? And no regulation reflects this. No policy reflects this. Females are just as invisible in this picture as the radiation we're talking about is invisible.
Well, when you hear something like that from a genuine nuclear expert, you begin to get that sinking feeling that you, too, are in that seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. This week, two interviews on radiation and what it can do and has done to all of us. First, Mary Olson of genderandradiation.org shares startling information on how radiation exposure rates do not impact all ages and biological genders equally. And then epidemiologist Joseph Mangano talks about his 2016 report on thyroid cancer's invisible epidemic. Today is Tuesday, November 12, 2019, and here are these two special interviews on nuclear impact from a different perspective. First, Mary Olson. She is a retiring member of Nuclear Information and Resource Service, referred to as NIRS, where she served for almost 30 years on staff. She is now acting director of Gender and Radiation Impact Project. We spoke for this interview on Sunday, October 21st, 2018. First of all, what is the Gender and Radiation Impact Project?
It's the outgrowth of work that really began 10, 15 years ago now, where 60 years of data on the survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the horrific thing that we will talk a little bit more about, but that data was published in 2006, 60 years of tracking people who'd all had one big burst of radiation. In that data, we discovered that males and females are different. And as I've gone along educating people, it's become clear that we need a further literature, published papers. We need to start digging into the science, because we can't hope for change in policy around radiation, reflecting the gender difference, reflecting the age difference, unless and until we have a published literature. So the goal of the Gender and Radiation Impact Project is to start that ball rolling.
Let's clarify, because there are now so many meanings attached to the word gender. What does its use here signify?
I agree. So honestly, we should be saying biological sex, male and female, whether you have two X chromosomes or whether you have an XY. And indeed, in even the last 10 years, our society has moved so far into the dialogue of what does it mean to have an identity that is formed around our gender, and what does gender mean if there aren't just two genders, and all those very complex and very interesting things. And so I honestly have to start by apologizing that when I started talking about this, I was often the only woman in a room full of men in suits, or nuclear industry people, federal government people, congress people, And if I started with the word sex, they weren't going to listen. They were just going to have their eyes crossed and go off on other tangents. And I was going to be dismissed immediately. So I took the softer word, the broader word, back in 2011 when I published my first paper, and have been using it since. And so it's good to acknowledge that there are many layers and many levels of engagement with this word gender, with these ideas of our identity. And in this case, we're talking about biology. Little girls were born in Japan and they were exposed to radiation. Little boys were born in Japan and exposed to radiation during the horrific act of dropping the first nuclear weapons on cities full of people. I always have to acknowledge it was my government that did that, and that if I could roll back history, I would never have, you know, if I ruled the universe, it would never have happened. So since it happened, I always say I am so very sorry that these people were subjected to this. But amazingly, people who survived the atomic bombing by the United States of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there were 100,000 people, actually a little more than 100,000 people. Mm-hmm. 5 years in, a study was initiated by the military occupation of Japan, was by the United States, and during that time, this study was initiated. So a data set was formed that has tracked those people for 60 years. It's called the Lifespan Study, and in that study, the data has been collected by many different bodies, but the National Academy of Science published the numbers, not just the conclusions, but the actual numbers in 2006. And in those numbers is where we get this information that it matters whether you're born a boy or born a girl, because across their lifetimes, little boys got cancer, and that's the only thing they're looking at here is cancer. Little boys did get cancer, but of the total group of boys and girls, girls got twice as much across their lifetime as did the little boys.
Why would that be the case?
Well, that is what Gender and Radiation Impact Project is dedicated to, raising funds to support current experts in radiation to start adding questions on biological sex to their studies to begin getting at why. Why would there be a difference between male and female?
In your studies, the work that you have done, what have you come up with as possible explanations for this?
My mentor, Dr. Rosalie Bertel, who gave her adult life to working with radiation-impacted communities and studying all this, her theory, she was right at the end of her life when I wrote my paper, a testable hypothesis is that there is more hot tissue. Reproductive tissue is more reactive with radiation harm than other types of living tissue. So in her view, the greater amount of reproductive tissue in a female body compared to a male body could be the cause. That's a testable hypothesis. It hasn't been tested.
So when people say that women are more vulnerable to radiation, that it has a stronger impact on us, right now that is backed up by numbers, but the cause is a hypothesis. We don't exactly know why. Is that correct?
Correct. And there's actually multiple hypotheses. I gave you the first one that Rosalie came up with. Other people say, well, could it be the amount of fatty tissue? Because we know that radiation and fatty tissue interacts, and we know that female bodies generally have more subcutaneous fat. And again, mammary glands, our breasts have a lot more fat. There's places in our bodies that that could be the factor. That's a second hypothesis. A third one has to do with maturation rate. Generally, females hit puberty faster than boys. But the interesting thing to me is that the biggest difference is in the youngest children. There aren't occupational differences so much. We're more the same size overall when we're little kids. There's just a lot of issues that drop out in terms of lifestyle. Points to fundamental body difference.
There is something called reference man, which is the model used for figuring out through the nuclear industry, and I believe through the medical establishment as well, what the impact is of radiation exposure. What is reference man, and what is wrong with using him as the standard for calculating radiation impact?
reference man is like a scenario, an envelope, if you will. And he's defined by the International Committee for Radiological Protection. I'm not good at keeping numbers in my head, so I'll just tell you that he's a relatively young guy between 25 and 30, kind of average height between 5'5 and 6 foot. His weight is defined. He's defined by his climate as North American or Northern European. He is defined as Caucasian and having an industrial lifestyle. So Native American people are always very unhappy with reference man. Now, at the time that the ICRP defined reference man, it was during the Cold War, and it corresponded to decisions that had already been made years earlier, when the largest groups of people exposed to radioactivity that human beings have made, let's be clear, we started splitting atoms, Libby. People started splitting atoms in 1942. Young people don't realize that this is like all in the last 100 years, you know? So at the time they started, it was all young men, military men. This idea of a reference man fit because radioactivity was confined to places like Los Alamos and Oak Ridge and Nevada Test Site. And you're sending people into those places and you were figuring out standards that would quote unquote protect them in those places. When they started putting nuclear facilities in so many hundreds of different locations on virtually street corners in some cases, started dental x-rays in primary school, started all kinds of radioactive applications in medicine, nobody ever stopped and said, gee, are we all reference men? You know, at that point, they're exposing everybody. And nobody said, does reference man still apply? And I want to, before we go a little further, and we will go a little further, I want to note that the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the federal regulator for most commercial licenses in the United States, all the reactors and fuel cycle facilities and medicine and all of that is licensed by this one agency. They use reference man to this day, which means that anything about a female body is invisible to all of their standards, all of their licenses, all of their policies. Now, the Environmental Protection Agency sets the national scope, which the NRC supposedly is implementing. And that EPA is the Environmental Protection Agency. And they say they pay attention to females. I found out how they pay attention to us, Libby.
And how is that?
They look at the numbers from the lifespan study as if they are a community or a population. And these guys do not have biology as their degrees at all, not even medicine or public health. They're physics guys. And they look at those impacts to little girls and they say little girls are a subpopulation.
What in the world do they mean by a subpopulation?
Well, in their mind, somebody is a little girl over there and they're being affected in a way that they don't have to deal with because not everybody is a little girl. And yes, they will deal with subpopulations, but later. But I said, stop the music when they told me this. And I said to them, little girls in Chicago are a subpopulation, or little girls in Paris are a subpopulation, but little girls are an inextricable link in the human life cycle. And the man who's telling me that a little girl is a subpopulation wouldn't be sitting there as an adult male without a whole lot of little girls who got him there because his mother was a little girl and his two grandmothers were little girls and on. We are not subpopulation. We are how our species generates and regenerates, right? And little boys too. You cannot have this whole picture, even with test tubes, without little girls or little boys. So they don't understand this. And very sadly, the biological community has vacated and left all this to these people who are clueless, just clueless, Libby.
One of the things on the site that we will be talking about, your superb new site, genderandradiation.org, is a graphic that shows an outline of reference man and next to it an outline of a little girl. And just the physiological mass of the two bodies is so radically different that it's only common sense that the impact would be different on the bodies from the same dose of radiation.
Indeed. And we have long known that radiation exposure is more harmful to children. What we did not know until the National Academy of Science published 60 years of data from Hiroshima and Nagasaki is that children are not all the same. So the little boy between the age of birth and five, see, they divided by the age people were at the time they were exposed when those bombs went off in 1945. They divided the population into these age cohorts. And then they tracked each group over 60 years. And obviously the people who were elders at the time of the bombing died sooner. But all that's adjusted for in the numbers that we look at. And we're talking about excess cancers over and above the expected rate in a population that wasn't exposed. This is basic epidemiology. So in the group of children who were children in 1945 when they got this exposure, boys were five times more likely to get cancer than the adult male who underpins the reference man. But little girls were 10 times more likely to get cancer over their lifetimes than the man who was adult at the time of exposure. And so that five times versus 10 times, both of them are far higher than reference man, but that's the doubling that I'm talking about, that little girls were twice as likely than little boys. And that's the big question, why? And also, note to self, no regulation reflects this. No policy reflects this. Females are just as invisible in this picture as the radiation we're talking about is invisible. There is zero recognition of what I'm talking about.
How do we change this?
Well, I spent the last, I wrote the paper, Atomic Radiation is More Harmful to Women in 2011. So we're talking about a 7-year period in which I've been talking to lots of people, including medical doctors and some medical associations, medical educators, and they are individuals. They cannot turn and act as a group unless they have more published literature, more papers, more chapters in books, more experts to hang their hats on. And I have done PowerPoints. Dr. Arjun Makkajani wrote a very pivotal paper called Science for the Vulnerable with a whole team of people on this topic, but there are none of them in scientific peer-reviewed journals. And so Gender and Radiation Impact Project is a commitment to move that forward so that somebody in the policy arena who wanted to make a change would have a basis to do that.
What are the places you didn't mention where you have addressed some very influential people, or hopefully influential people, is at the United Nations. Tell us about that.
I am pleased and proud to report that the disproportionate impact of radiation on girls and on women became a vehicle at the diplomatic community at the global level for an amazing new thing. We have a new global treaty on nuclear weapons called the Convention on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. Today, as we speak, 69 nations have signed this treaty. Of them, 19 have gotten to the level of ratifying it, meaning that their parliaments or congresses or whoever has to say yes to a treaty to take it into force. As soon as there are 50 nations that have ratified, the treaty will come into force. And what it does, just briefly, and then we'll go back to how the girls and women and radiation helped it. What it does is give the force of humanitarian law at the global level to any nation that declares itself to be nuclear free. New Zealand did this when I was in college, and we all had parties and saluted New Zealand for being a nuclear free zone. But it had no force of law behind it, and other nations came and rained radioactivity down upon it. France tested nuclear weapons in the South Pacific. The U.S. violated it with bringing submarines carrying nuclear weapons in, and there was no force of law to protect New Zealand's declaration. So this new treaty actually makes it so that countries that sign and ratify have the right to declare themselves nuclear free on their lands and waters. And this is major. This is something that so many people across the United States and across the world, whether they were a freeze voter or they were part of Peace Action or they were part of Sane Freeze or they were part of any number of International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War or Physicians for Social Responsibility. There are hundreds and hundreds of local peace organizations that have worked for disarmament. And this treaty kind of came a little bit out of the blue for them. And part of my commitment at the moment is to bring it home, to say, this is ours. This came from every single effort that anyone ever made to say that nuclear weapons are madness and we must turn away from them. And so it just moves me that as the treaty was being finalized, I was told by the man who led the effort that the news that radiation was more harmful to girls and more harmful to women compared to boys and to men was what attracted the openness to consider that something new could happen on nuclear. Because so many people in the diplomatic community were just jaded and hardened to any notion of nuclear weapons, that you could do anything about them. They had become static and immovable, and nobody wanted to hear about them or talk about them. But being able to walk up and hand them my paper, and they went, what? And just that little opening. You wouldn't ever drop a nuclear bomb because you were going to kill more women or girls. That would never be the reason. And in fact, you use it for the fireball, for the blast, for the destructive energy. It's not the radiation that anyone ever used a nuclear weapon for. But this finding that even building them, even processing the materials, even operating reactors, all of the steps along the way, have been more harmful to girls and to women than we know because we haven't been looking, was a good enough reason for someone to sit down and go, what? What are you talking about? And that's how they moved the entire General Assembly to vote to move forward on the treaty. And when they had written the treaty, to move the entire General Assembly to vote for ratification. Whether our country will ever sign is an open question. We never signed on the landmine treaty either. The United States and Singapore are the only two nations that never signed the landmine treaty. So if we go to war, we can only put landmines here and in Singapore. If we do the same with nuclear, I think it's going to be a better situation than what we have had for my lifetime. So I am so pleased and so proud that writing a paper called Atomic Radiation is More Harmful to Women helped that to move.
Thank you for having written that. Thank you for having brought that to the United Nations. And how good that there are countries with representatives who are sane enough to recognize that nuclear is a threat to our entire life cycle as a species and that it needs to be protected at the highest level possible.
Indeed. And, you know, the Nobel Peace Prize went to the grassroots side of that effort, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, ICAN, received the Nobel Prize in 2017. And I was so pleased to watch that ceremony. It's on YouTube. And I so recommend hearing Setsuko Thurlow Hibakusha, a woman who survived the bombing in 1945, speak, and Beatrice Finn, who heads the ICAN organization. And at the same time, I want to say again, it belongs to everybody. That award belongs to my mother, who was with Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. It belongs to the little PSR chapter here, Physicians for Social Responsibility. It belongs to PeaceLinks people. It belongs to freeze voters, who were hundreds of thousands of people across this country. It belongs to everybody.
Let's get back to what radiation does, what we know that radiation does to the elements of the reproductive process, specifically eggs, fetuses, and even sperm. What is the impact? What is the known consequence of exposure?
The first thing we say is that radiation impacts our cells, and reproduction is all about cells. A lot of people who haven't grown up in a family of biologists like I did may not relate to the terms primary germ cells, but the primary germ cells are our species, you know, like a library, like a treasure trove of our genetic background as a species as a whole, but as our family coming down through the generations. And in the case of females, these are our eggs, ova, in the ovaries. And in the case of males, it's the spermatogonia, which are the cells that make sperm every 20 minutes, and the sperm themselves. And interestingly enough, both of these are formed when a child pre-birth is a fetus in its mother. The spermatogonia and the ova that will be that mother's grandchildren are formed during that pregnancy of the child. A woman does not make any more ova in the course of her life. She's born with all of them. And a male does not make new spermatogonia, the cells that make the sperm. He's born with those. And although sperm is turned over on a pretty rapid level, it can be impacted by anything that happened in that pre-birth time in the grandmother's body. So this is a very interesting interlacing. At any given moment, a pregnant woman has three generations present, and a non-pregnant woman or man has two generations present. And so radiation impacts truly are incredibly complicated.
Given what you've just said about the grandparents' impact, would it be safe to say that when a woman gives birth, what's being expressed is any radiation impact that may have taken place on her mother, meaning the new baby's or the fetus's grandparent, meaning that any impact on her would be playing out two generations down the line as well? Is that making sense?
In broad brush, I agree with that construct. And so in a very real way, I was an ova prior to 1958. And the ova that I came from was formed in 1919. You see, my mother's birthday was my ova's birthday, but I didn't become an embryo until I was fertilized in 1958. So we have now, sitting in almost 2019, 100 years of cellular activity that is me. Back in 1919, it was a single cell. And, you know, you're somewhat protected talking about a single cell because it has to be a pretty precise hit or a pretty large saturation to get a single cell. But it happens. And when it happens, it was Dr. Alice Stewart who said that childhood cancer is post-birth defect. It is not something that happens to a child. It's something that happened before the child was born.
So with our far more radiation saturated environment, with so many more possibilities of exposure, as well as the epidemic that seems to be taking place of childhood cancers, as well as other rare diseases, what is the possibility that we not only haven't seen the end of this, but that it's going to get a lot worse as the years continue to roll by?
Again, I agree with what you said in broad brush, but my brain was actually putting it a slightly different way, which is that given the 60 years of Hiroshima-Nagasaki survivor data, which does not include information about people who weren't born yet. It's only people who had been born. But still, we can say categorically that our current evaluation of radiation impact is off by a factor of 10 for half the society, and by a factor of 5 for the other half of society, being females in the first case and males in the second, because we were all exposed as children to the Cold War and the testing and the fallout and now all the nuclear industry, and then certainly all of the pediatric radiation that we go through. So we know for fact certain that the reporting is off in terms of what's attributed to radiation. And then we know for fact certain, given the latency periods, that absolutely the more contamination and exposure you get in the environment to things that require a latency period of probably, I'm going to say probably, because I think we're changing our ideas about this too, but 10 to 30 years, well, that means that an exposure today is going to show up in 10 or 30 years as a consequence. And so, yes, it's a ball that's rolling and accelerating as it rolls. Absolutely.
What are you hoping that the Gender and Radiation Impact Project achieves?
Well, my greatest goal that I would feel so happy if we did is a Surgeon's General warning. Because although I've been a grassroots activist and participated in people moving and demanding, I hate the picture of a little girl in a medical office trying to stand off with her doctor because she knows what the doctor does not know, that that radiation is more harmful to her than people have been aware of. And this little girl is trying to stick up for herself. That just makes me want to cry. And so the idea that we could get something like a Surgeon's General warning that would be on everything that has anything to do with radiation, including things like airplane tickets. Hello. They always make the analogy to airlines, you know, and flying across the United States to dismiss the harm of radiation. But in fact, it is quite harmful to fly all the time, and particularly to retaining pregnancy. We know this. So anyway, I would love to have everything labeled that says, oh, by the way, if you're dealing with a little girl or a little boy, and this is optional, you might want to be twice as cautious with your little girl as you are with your little boy. I mean, hopefully the regulators will catch up if we do something like that. But right now, the regulators, I can tell you for fact certain, are bought, sold, and delivered to the industries that depend on their regulations to be legal. They will not regulate more tightly because that would cause the industries to be either more expensive or not viable at all. So, you know, I think we're going to have to go outside and force them from a different angle. And I do think the medical community could do it, but I don't think they're going to do it unless there's a lot more science behind them.
The website that you have just put up, genderandradiation.org, truly is superb in terms of its organization of the information, the clarity of it, and the way you lead people through the issues in a way that we can really grab onto it. So for those who wish to learn more, what are the resources that you have available on the genderandradiation.org site?
I think some of the most easy to follow but take you further in are the PowerPoints that are posted as PDF files under the resource section and or the videos of the talks I've given at the UN. But there's also a resource page that has links to quite a few different more complex things like Dr. Arjun Makajani's paper in 2006 and the World Health Organization report. Several different resources. But the fact is, we have a very thin array of published papers. And that's why we're doing the project, to get more papers published. And quite frankly, to have a new generation of experts who are getting their PhDs and their MDs by doing this work. We will get both. We'll get the literature and we'll get the people who are aware, awake, and involved with these questions. In addition, there's a website called ResearchGate, one word, and you just search Mary Olson and gender and radiation, and that's a second place where people can find just the papers. Genderandradiation.org is a great place to start.
Mary Olson, she is a retiring member of the staff of Nuclear Information and Resource Service, or NIRS, and acting director of Gender and Radiation Impact Project. For more information on her critical work, as she suggested, go to the website genderandradiation.org. We'll have our second interview with Joseph Mangano in just a moment. But first, someone recently said to me, Did you know that Nuclear Hot Seat is the world's longest continuously running weekly program devoted exclusively to nuclear issues? I hadn't thought about it in those terms, but as the show is now in its ninth year, that is the truth. I was then asked, how do you do it? And I could only say, with a little help from my friends. Those friends, meaning you, you who are listening right now, variously provide information, links, text suggestions when I get hung up in digital problems, a steady stream of attagirls and info corrections, all of which help keep me in the full upright position and the show's content on an even, accurate keel. And some of you do the crucial job of helping with the ever-necessary financial support, which covers the website, support services, digital surfaces and software purchases, travel expenses to cover nuclear events, and a whole host of other bills. Now, we are embarking on the long-needed upgrade of the website, which requires a large lump-sum outlay. And for that, we need a lot of assistance, a lot of your assistance. So if you want to help make Nuclear Hot Seat more visible, searchable, and easier to navigate, now is the time to do so. Don't think, wow, that's a great idea. Someone should do it. Right now is the time, and the person is you. So hit the pause button and take action. Send a donation of any size by going to nuclearhotseat.com and clicking on the big red donate button. Please, do what you can to help Nuclear Hot Seat keep going and growing as we search out and share cutting-edge nuclear information that helps you know about and understand lots of things that the nuclear industry would rather you not know about. Whatever you can do to help Nuclear Hot Seat achieve its updated website, you have my gratitude. Now here's our second interview, this one with Joseph Mangano. He is an epidemiologist and executive director of Radiation and Public Health Project, a research group so long established it has a web address that consists of a single word, radiation.org. Joe is our own Sherlock Holmes, examining health statistics to tease out the nuclear messages hidden within. In this interview from 2016, he refers to the then-recent article written by him and Dr. Janet Sherman. It's called An Invisible Epidemic About Thyroid Cancer Rates in Proximity to Nuclear Reactors, Including Fukushima Daiichi. I'm saddened to report that Dr. Sherman passed away just last week, on November 7, 2019, at the age of 89. Here's an opportunity to learn about and honor her important work, which continues to inform our work against all things nuclear. First of all, I don't think we've ever done this. Explain what an epidemiologist is and what such a person does.
Epidemiologist is a fancy word for a statistician who does work in the health field, health statistics. It's basically the study of patterns of disease, patterns of death, and patterns of other health trends.
You work with Dr. Janet Sherman, and the two of you focus your studies, at least the ones that I've seen, on nuclear radiation-related issues. Why did you choose this area of study?
Let me define what we study, because this is really what the whole group does, the Radiation and Public Health Project. Radiation can mean several things. It can mean natural radiation in the rocks in the air. It can mean medical radiation, such as x-rays and scans, or it can mean a certain type of radiation called ionizing radiation. And that means two discrete things. One, atomic bombs, and two, the chemicals that are used in nuclear power reactors to make electricity. Our focus has been on the nuclear reactors. There are 99 in this country. There are about just under 400 around the world that make electricity by taking a uranium atom and splitting it exactly the way it's done to explode an atomic bomb.
You recently published an article, An Invisible Epidemic, Can an Epidemic Really Sneak Up on Us Like This?, about thyroid cancer. What led you to write this particular article at this time?
Well, what I just described in my last answer was nuclear reactors produce electricity. There's one problem with reactors, and that is the chemicals that are produced in reactors to make this electricity are dangerous. They are radioactive chemicals, chemicals we don't find in nature, chemicals we first observed or first were created in the 1940s during World War II in the race to make the atomic bomb. Different chemicals such as iodine-131, strontium-90, cesium-137. Each of them, as I said, is radioactive. Each of them, if it enters a human body or an animal or plant, is harmful. It gets into the body. The body is damaged, the cells are damaged, and it can lead to various diseases such as cancer. That's how I got to thyroid cancer. And there are hundreds of these, by the way, between 100 and 200 separate chemicals. I named three of them, but there are many, many more. Each of them goes to a different part of the body. Thyroid cancer, which our most recent article was about, is the home of radioactive iodine chemicals. The thyroid gland uses iodine, non-radioactive iodine, as a part of functioning normally. However, radioactive iodine is not normal. And when it is released from a nuclear power plant or from an atomic bomb explosion, and it's taken into the body, it immediately goes from the stomach to the bloodstream and right to the thyroid gland, which is a little gland. It looks like a butterfly. It's wrapped around the throat. And unlike natural radiation, the radioactive iodine attacks cells. It kills them, it impairs them, and leads to disease.
What are the current thyroid cancer rates, and why the need for alarm? Why do you call this an epidemic?
Radiation, as I said, is hundreds of chemicals that are out there. They're being released. They go into the body. Radioactive iodine in thyroid cancer is kind of special for a couple of reasons. First of all, we know that the thyroid gland is very sensitive to iodine, and especially in the very young, during pregnancy and infancy and childhood. We also know that if you ask any doctor what causes thyroid cancer, the list is extremely short. The Mayo Clinic only has three causes. One is being a female, females get it more, which is really not a cause. And number two is having certain genetic patterns. Well, that's not a cause either. There's something that caused these odd genetic patterns. The third and final cause, the Mayo Clinic says, is exposure to ionizing radiation. So we know there's a direct contact. And in the last 70 years of the atomic era, thyroid cancer has probably been the most studied, along with childhood cancer, has been the most studied of any type of disease compared to the radiation it takes in. And as far as rates go, in the early 1990s, every year in the United States, about 12,000 new cases were diagnosed. Now, the number is 62,000. All right, it's gone up more than five times, and every year it's going up and up and up. Males and females, whites and blacks and Hispanics, people in cities, in rural areas, it is just all over our society, and no one has really quite put their finger on why, and that's what we're trying to do.
How likely is it that the improvements in the detection of thyroid cancer, better equipment and better detection systems available, are, as some are claiming,
are the reason why we're catching
more cases at an earlier time?
That's a very good question, and the answer is sure. Better detection systems are probably a reason for this higher number. However, it's probably a small reason, and I'll tell you why. There's two ways to detect thyroid cancer. There is no screening program like mammography for breast cancer or colonoscopy for colon cancer. There's no screening program for thyroid cancer. It's detected in two ways. Number one, on a routine visit to a doctor, and he palpates or touches the throat area and feels a lump. And number two, in the cases of more advanced thyroid cancers, symptoms. You know, there's some sort of pain or discomfort that the patient reports to the doctor. There's really no evidence that compared to the 1990s, doctors are doing a better job in palpating, something they've been doing for decades. There's no real evidence that patients are more wise to reporting any sort of pain or discomfort. It's been going on for years. So again, there's probably some part of the increases is due to better detection, but it's probably quite small. The rest of it is a big question mark. And this is what we're trying to get at, because thyroid cancer is fast becoming one of the most common cancers in our society. It's the seventh most common now. It was 20th years ago, and now it's moving up rapidly.
What are the possible causes of this thyroid cancer spike?
Our focus was strictly on the radiation theory as a cause. And yes, there may be some portion of it, of the thyroid cancer rise, due to a sort of delayed response to the atomic bomb tests of the 1950s and 60s, which were done above the ground and sent fallout across the country, and which came back into the environment through rain and snow and were taken in food and water. There may be some of that, but these haven't been done since the 1960s. Probably the more likely answer are the 99 reactors in this country that are generating electricity, nuclear power reactors. As I said, there's 99 of them. The highest we've ever had was 112. They're also getting very old and very corroded, and they're leaking more, you see, as they get older. They're not really building any reactors for quite some time now. So our feeling was that this is the main reason. And plus, it's not just a feeling. In 2009, I published a medical journal article which showed the highest rates in the country of thyroid cancer are in a 90-mile radius, a circle encompassing eastern Pennsylvania, southern New York, central New Jersey. In that 90-mile ball are 16 reactors. 13 of them are still operating. It is the most dense concentration of reactors in this country, and one of them happens to be Three Mile Island, which, of course, suffered a partial meltdown in 1979. So that is another piece of evidence that says reactors releases are causing this thyroid cancer increase.
Is there any correlation between a closer proximity? You're talking about a 90-mile radius. But is there any study or any evidence that the closer you get to the reactor, the higher the risk that one faces of developing thyroid cancer?
Yes. Our organization, about a decade ago, did the only study ever that looked at radiation levels in bodies of Americans living near nuclear reactors. We called it the Tooth Fairy Project, which sounds like a little game, but it was a serious scientific study looking at the levels of another radioactive chemical, strontium-90, in baby teeth. It wasn't our idea. Several studies have been done starting in the 1950s. And we found that near six nuclear plants, the levels of strontium-90 were quite a bit higher in the counties where the reactors were located, about 40%, 50% higher than further areas. So we know that the closer you are to a reactor, the more it gets into your body.
What correlation, if any, is there to Fukushima and the ongoing radiation release that is happening there?
There's a lot of correlation. Even though when I'm talking about reactors releasing radioactivity, it's more of an ongoing thing. We call them routine releases. A reactor can't run without routinely releasing a portion of the radioactivity it produces. Okay, then in the case of Fukushima 5 years ago, and also in history, as I mentioned, Three Mile Island in the 70s and Chernobyl in the 1980s, very, very large amounts of radiation are released. Fukushima, the experts are still discussing it, but it is either the first or second worst meltdown in nuclear history. And unfortunately, it's still not controlled. The releases are still going on. They're still getting into the air and into the Pacific Ocean, and they're still heading to the United States. Interestingly, the Fukushima Medical University is studying children who live near Fukushima, about 300,000 of them, and they have found in 4 years that there have been 127 new cases of thyroid cancer, which doesn't sound like much, but in a normal population like that, there should be about 8. So we're talking about, 30 times, 40 times more than expected, which again, backs up our theory that the more iodine, the more radiation you're exposed to, the higher your risk of diseases like thyroid cancer.
Make a distinction, if you would, between the dangers of external radiation, which I think is what most people think about, just the rays coming at you, the nuclear particles coming at you, and internal exposure when you have either eaten or drunk something that has radiation in it.
First of all radiation has a risk, even if it's used for a good purpose. You know, a doctor gives you an x-ray to diagnose a disease you might have, or gives you a CAT scan, or sometimes radiation therapy to treat a disease. Yes, these are helpful uses of the atom, but of course, any physician, any scientist will tell you that there is a risk involved. Now, with external radiation, as you mentioned, which occurs like in scans and x-rays, it's a beam, it's a ray, and it goes zipping right through your body. Zoom. In fact, nothing can stop an x-ray except for lead. However, it doesn't stick around very long. Within milliseconds, it zips right through. Now, with these chemicals created by atomic bombs or nuclear reactors, that's different. They get into the air, and they are taken into the body either by breathing or food or water. And then they go to the whatever organ that they are attracted to. Iodine heads for the thyroid gland. Strontium heads for bone and for teeth. Cesium disperses throughout all the soft tissues. Okay, these are specific poisons that do specific jobs on the human body. And in the case of like a strontium 90, which has been discussed for, back to the 50s and 60s in the debate whether to keep bomb testing or not, it gets into the bone and the bone marrow. And in the bone marrow are the red and the white blood cells, which is the immune army, all right? Any chance a human has of fighting off a disease depends on your red and white blood cells. And strontium attacks these white blood cells, okay? That became a real rallying cry, which led President Kennedy to cease all above bomb tests.
Where do you pull your statistics from that you base your studies on?
Yeah, the statistic on thyroid cancer are all official statistics reported by health departments and eventually to the National Cancer Institute.
So what response have you gotten to these studies, to this article, say, either in the government or in any official body that is dealing with the cancer epidemic?
Typically, to this article and to other articles we've written, we have done 34 articles in scientific journals. Typically, there is either no response from government and industry or a denial. No, it can't be releases from reactors. The levels are just too low to cause harm. Well, that's like saying, if you smoke 3 cigarettes a day, it's okay. That's a low level. It can't be harmful. Well, it's not as much as 3 packs a day, but it is going to cause some sort of harm. And the government has really been rather silent, and industry have been rather silent on this thyroid epidemic.
What do you say to those individuals who try and make us believe that your methodology is flawed in getting the results that you do get?
Yes, very often there are critiques from industry and from government. Of course, the issue there is, where are their studies proving that nuclear reactors are safe? The answer is there are none. Okay? They just make a statement and they say, below a certain level, it's safe. Okay, we're going to measure how much you release. Oh, it's below a certain level. It's safe. That's not very good science. That's very poor science, actually. As far as studies that are out there that in medical journals that are proving the safety, they simply don't exist. In 60 years of running nuclear reactors, there has only been one government study of cancer near nuclear reactors. And the only reason that was done in the late 80s was because Senator Ted Kennedy forced them to do it. And since then, there have been none. They tried to get another one going a few years ago, and this year the Nuclear Regulatory Commission canceled the study. I think that's really not doing a disservice to the American people, who have a right to know if the air they're breathing and the food they're eating and the water they're drinking is harming them or not.
Knowing what you do about the impact of radiation on the thyroid and certainly on our total physical health. What, if anything, do you advise people do to protect themselves?
As a group, our work is to simply do the studies and to try to document the possible risks of radiation. As far as what people can do for themselves, we've really not taken an official stance on it. But I can tell you this, that if people become involved in helping to shut down nuclear reactors so that we can get our electricity from much safer sources, totally safe sources, such as solar and wind, that would be helpful. This, in fact, happened over 50 years ago with the atomic bomb above ground tests. Many people were very upset that this fallout was going all over the place and all over the country and getting into our food. There were mass demonstrations in front of the White House, in front of the United Nations, demanding that President Kennedy sign this treaty, and in fact he did. And right after that treaty, the infant deaths went sharply down. Childhood cancer went sharply down. That treaty, which was not just the U.S., but the Soviet Union in England, probably saved millions of lives. It's the Limited Test Ban Treaty of 1963. If people get involved and demand that their leaders either prove safety or develop safer ways to make electricity, we can certainly change. And we know, too, that in studies we've done, when you close nuclear reactors immediately in the local county or two, there's an immediate drop in infant deaths, an immediate drop in child cancer, and over a long term, a drop in all cancers. So, again, this is a life-saving issue.
What's next for you and Dr. Sherman and Radiation and Public Health Project, RPHP?
You know, when we started the group back in 1989, there wasn't a whole lot of research done. Our total focus at that time was to get out studies, get out information on disease rates in nuclear plants, on how much radiation was getting in the body, such as the baby tooth study. As time has gone on and we have published these 34 articles and others have published the same, of course we're going to keep publishing new studies. But in addition, we're going to be doing just what I was discussing with you during the last question, putting this information out for the public to understand so that they can demand of their leaders that they be told the full truth about nuclear reactors and their hazards, and that they be better protected.
If a community or even an individual wanted to fund you and RPHP to create an epidemiological study on their area, how would they proceed to do that?
Yeah, we've done that quite frequently. We've done many, many studies for communities who are interested in knowing what's out there. No, the information is out there. You know, the statistics are in the computer. The National Cancer Institute collects it. But no one has analyzed it. No one has looked at, you know, the rates after a nuclear plant opens or closes or as it gets older. And they come to us. And we have done a number of those. Many of those are on our website as well.
Epidemiologist Joseph Mangano, Executive Director of the Radiation and Public Health Project Research Group. Their website is radiation.org. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, November 12, 2019. If you appreciate weekly verifiable news updates about nuclear news around the world, take a moment to send a donation of any size to nuclearhotseat.com. This is Libby Halevy reminding you that when it comes to nuclear, not only what you don't know can hurt you, chances are it already has. There you go. You have just had your nuclear wake-up call. So don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Question everything. Intelligent radio for intelligent people. UCY.TV.